and you're listening to Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight I have international best-selling author Brian Freeman, who not only has published with one author's traditional publisher, he's published with a couple traditional publishing houses. It's going to be really fun. He has two best-selling books this year. The most recent one is called Marathon. We're going to talk about that, and we're also going to talk about his other book called The Nightbird. Hold on just one second. I'm going to get Brian on the phone, and we'll be right back. For joining me tonight. I'm thrilled that you're here. Speaking of thrilled, Brian Freeman writes some of the best thrillers around. He's won practically every award there is or been nominated for it. His books are psychological thrillers. They've been sold in 46 countries and more than 20 languages. The secret, I think, to Brian's books are that he writes haunting characters and a really lightning fast pace. His characters are driven by emotions and secrets. I cannot wait for you to hear about his new book, Marathon. Please welcome to the show, Brian Freeman. Brian, so good to have you on Authors on the Air. How are you this evening?
I'm doing great. I'm happy to be with you tonight.
I'm happy you're with me, too. I'll tell you what, we got rained out last week, and I'm so glad we're able to do it this week. Weather in your part of the woods is nice, though, right?
Yeah, this is one of those rare times of the year when we can brag a little in Minnesota. It doesn't happen very often, but we'll take it when we can get it.
Absolutely. You know, Brian, I breeze through your book, but I do read quite fast. And I like the fact that your books are so fast-paced. You barely get to gulp a breath of air at the end of each chapter when you're just kind of plowing right into the next suspense arc of the book. Do you wear yourself out when you go back and read what you're writing? Your brain must work so fast when you're trying to put words to paper.
Well, you know, that is really what I'm going after, is that lightning pace. One of my favorite emails was from a reader who told me that she'd been reduced to taking illicit bathroom breaks at work to get in another chapter. I figure that's me doing my job. So, you know, I want you to be having the dog not fed and the kids starting to smell a little because you're just not getting the chores done. You have to keep reading. And part of that's a deliberate, you know, creative technique in terms of how I kind of develop the chapters. And I'm always trying to construct the book in such a way that each chapter has a little hook that forces you to turn that page. And even if you're kind of eyeing that clock and thinking, oh, gosh, I've got to get up tomorrow. Well, you know, maybe just one more chapter.
You know, I typically read pretty quickly. And I was pretty breathless at the end of Marathon because the nature of the book, it's so ripped from the headlines, but there's so many different twists and turns in it. I kind of feel like I'm seeing the headlines, but from behind the scenes. I hope that was your intention, because that's how I read this book. Perhaps you would be so good as to describe Marathon to listeners right now.
Yeah, you know, I read a review the other day that said that Marathon kind of took the headlines and blew them up and showed you what was really going on behind the scenes. And I love that. That's very much what I was trying to do in this book. I don't think that with a title like Marathon, it will come as any surprise that the original inspiration for this book was the terrible tragedies at the Boston Marathon 4 years ago, and I saw that as everyone did, and was sort of riveted to everything that was going on in the city during those several days. And I was thinking about the fact that the marathon is such an integral part of the identity of the city of Boston, and a lot of people don't necessarily know it if they're not in the running community. But the marathon in Duluth is similarly a huge part of that city's identity, and tens of thousands of people around the country and around the world come to Duluth every summer for the marathon. In fact, this year's marathon is going to be run on Saturday. And so I knew that I wanted these themes to be a part of Jonathan Stride's world. But at the same time, I don't typically write terrorism thrillers, and I don't write big political kinds of thrillers. My books are more intimate. It's family drama. It's emotion that emerges out of the secrets and the backgrounds of the characters. And so I needed to kind of think about how I was going to take this subject matter and translate it into a Brian Freeman thriller and make it something that deals with some of the hard issues that we face in the world, but also does it in a way where it really is all about the individual characters, and it's all about the sort of one-by-one personal decisions that people make that sometimes can change the world for good and for bad.
You know what was fascinating to me, and I want to just kind of skim through some of the book reviews on this from the professional reviewers. Brian Freeman has his finger on the pulse of technology. His use of social media in Marathon feels so real that readers may find themselves searching for hashtags. I noticed that too. It felt like I had to blink through my memory to think, wait a minute, I haven't been on Twitter in a long time. So, and I haven't looked for those things typically in a long time. But every single comment about you is how fast-paced and how thought-provoking every single thing that you do is, that you write is. And interesting that Booklist, who is usually a bear to get a review from, said tweets inspire actions with a dreadful, if sometimes unintended, consequences. And I want to think, boy, if Twitter's not out there in the world today, I don't know what is. It's got to be the biggest social media there is. So you really were kind of way ahead of your time using social media the way you have in Marathon. Why did you decide to use that?
Yeah, I really wanted to make social media almost a character of its own in this book.
In fact,
as you read Marathon, what you see is that the incident that happens at the Marathon in Duluth actually happens off stage. And I sort of tiptoe the reader up to the moment of something happening. And then the way you find out that there's been an event is tweets start to appear. And that's so much the way that people find out about events these days is it's through social media. It's things start to appear on Facebook and Twitter, and immediately you start to see this information spread virally like wildfire. And that's good to the extent that it really is an extraordinary pipeline for getting information out to a huge number of people quickly. The hard part is that at the same time, you get rumor and speculation and wild misinformation that gets spread as well with that same speed. And when you're talking about this kind of a horrible, violent event, the result can be it kind of adds a whole new layer and dimension to what the police have to deal with, because they're not just in that case of they already have a tough enough job trying to figure out, well, who's responsible for this event and trying to prevent more violence. But they now have this whole extra layer of social media and information going that they kind of have to try to control and react to. And in many cases, bad information starts getting out there, and it kind of changes the way the police have to do their jobs.
It used to be that police in any type of an event had to deal with media, with the press, whether it was radio or television or print right there. With the immediacy of social media in John Doe and Jane Smith's hands makes news happen immediately. And we've seen it just in our everyday lives with either police shootings or robberies or dog nappings or whatever it happens to be. People use their cell phone and their social media for everything. And sometimes reporting before police have any idea what's going on. So it's an interesting dilemma that you've created. Yes.
Yeah, it means that ordinary people wind up sort of having a role in these investigations that really is difficult and dangerous at times. And I was thinking about, as I was pulling this book together, I was thinking about an event that happened much longer ago, long before the timeline of social media came along, and that was the Centennial Park bombing in Atlanta during the Olympics. And
I was there long before
you know social media existed. And at the time, all of the suspicion fell incorrectly on the head of this security guard. I believe his name was Richard Jewell.
Right.
And his life was turned upside down by these false accusations. And my immediate thought as I was pulling this book together was, what if you had that kind of situation that emerged at the bombing in Atlanta? And what if you had that happening in the age of social media, when not only can a false accusation be spread by the mainstream media, but can also be spread like lightning by social media, and all of a sudden you can have literally millions of people all looking at this one person and thinking, yeah, that's the guy, he's the one that did it, whether or not that person is guilty or not.
And that presents challenges, you know, in real life, but also in your story. My God, it's so great. I don't want to give away any spoilers on this book. It's just too rich and too raw and too good for me to give away any spoilers. But needless to say, from the tone of Brian and I's conversation, you're getting an idea of what happens to one individual because of social media, which begs the question, do you use social media yourself?
I do. Social media has an important role to play in the world, and certainly for authors, social media is an incredibly powerful tool. I mean, I can now build relationships with readers, and my wife, who is my partner in this business, does the same, and between the two of us, we can maintain relationships with readers in a way that would have been impossible before social media. And in so many ways, the book business has changed so much in the past decade social media opened up this very important avenue by which authors can reach readers directly. And so when they have a new book out, they have this channel to be able to say, well, hey, the new book's out, go get it. Because so many of the older channels have kind of disappeared.
And talk show hosts who want to talk to you, too.
Well, there you go.
typically what happens is I get a press release and a galley from a publishing house or an author. And now, if there's somebody I want to speak to, most times I'm able to communicate on Facebook and invite someone to come on my show. It's an interesting thing, talking about when you reach out to your readers and your friends and everything. I don't know if you find this to be true or not, and this plays a little statistician to the end of your story, but people are very leery about who they want to be friends with anymore these days. Used to be anybody friend requested you, yeah, more friends the better, it's all great. Now we're all suspicious, but by the nature of how many mutual friends do we have, and I'm thinking, oh, thank God, I talk to a lot of authors. Otherwise, I wouldn't get to speak to some people, I wouldn't have a chance to. So I'm friends with them on social media. But it's an important tool, I agree. However, like anything else, never mind that television or cable news or radio or print gets it wrong so many times. Herein lies the rub with social media, because with Instagram and tweeting and Facebook and FaceTime and on camera live and everything else right from your cell phone itself has become a news medium, produced by an individual.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the trouble is that, it's always the case with any kind of media, and it's true with social media as well, is the first error is the one that gets all the attention. The correction that comes later gets no attention at all. And as a result, you sort of have these falsehoods that just get embedded in people's consciousness. And on virtually any major news event, you can kind of look down on Twitter and you'll start seeing people tweeting things that were debunked months or years ago, but it just gets it just fits into people's consciousness, and because they never see the information that corrects what went out the first time, they're still under the impression that
it
that
becomes
the
reality.
Information.
Exactly. It becomes their reality. I get that.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's true, and which is why you'll hear most reputable people say, check your sources, check your sources. I have to say that this book, just like your prior books, and I have sitting in front of me also The Nightbird, and I have Goodbye to the Dead. Your books are very carefully layered. But there are so many plots and so many dead ends, and I think you call them red herrings in the business, but it really left me breathless to read this book. It was really quite substantial and very, very enjoyable. So congratulations on that. I
want
to talk about next. You're welcome. It's my pleasure. My pleasure reading it, too. I want to talk about The Nightbird. You had such overwhelming success with this book, an amazing amount of success with this book. This is a frost-eaten mystery. It's the first one in the series. I'm assuming it's going to be a series, maybe, maybe not. But
yes, no,
this
the second
again,
one comes out January 30th. So.
Oh, okay, great. Well, I'm on the list. So I love this story. I love this story because we talk a lot, and folks, I'm talking about The Nightbird. In our everyday conversations with friends, we often talk about mental health and mental illness and all, and how dangerous untreated mental health is. But here you've kind of taken that and you've twisted it around again, another headline or another, topic that's relevant, and you've taken that and given it a twist. Will you talk about Frost Easton's story, please?
Yeah, absolutely. The Nightbird is all about the topic of manipulating memories, and I've always found that to be a fascinating subject. And I thought there's really a thriller to be made out of this, and I actually started doing some research into a Berkeley scientist by the name of Elizabeth Loftus, who has pretty much devoted her entire career to the issue of memory, and so I was watching TED talks that she had done and reading some of her papers, and it's fascinating because people I think sort of have the idea that memories are fixed in place, and in reality, a memory is just kind of like clay, and every time we take a memory out of our consciousness, it becomes soft and malleable, and oftentimes
very.
When we refile it, we refile it in just a little bit different way, and so that's the heart of this. I mean, there is a San Francisco psychiatrist by the name of Francesca Stein, and it usually takes readers just a little bit to get the joke of Frankie Stein. Her practice is a very controversial psychiatric practice because it's all about erasing the memories of trauma patients, and so other people in her field they question her techniques and they say you shouldn't be doing this. And Frankie's approach is, well, look, we would not hesitate to cut out a tumor that is harming someone's body. Why would we hesitate to cut out a memory if it's harming someone's psychiatric health? And the trouble is that what Frankie finds is that the consequences of these things are sometimes not what you anticipate, and these things can kind of come back to haunt you. And so when some of her patients that have had their memories altered begin to die in some fairly dramatic ways, Frost Easton of the San Francisco police has to figure out, what the connection is here, and is there somehow a killer out there who's managed to turn memories into a murder weapon? And that's sort of the concept behind The Nightbird. It was an awful lot of fun to pull together. I mean, it's a very visual, dramatic kind of book. All sorts of great set piece scenes. And, and I grew up in the Bay Area near San Francisco. And so I really enjoyed having the opportunity to start a new series based out in San Francisco, because I think it's an area that, you know, so many people around the world can embrace, and it's got such wonderful, dramatic, romantic elements that the city becomes a character in this book as well.
Absolutely. I want to go back to your conversation about Elizabeth Loftus. In one of the things I do in my real life, besides talking on the radio with wonderful people like you, is I am a certified victim advocate, and I work with domestic violence and sexual assault victims. Elizabeth Loftus is very well known for her work with recovered memories and false memories.
Yes.
And things like that, particularly in childhood sexual assault survivors. And it was very controversial when she started working on this, because there was no way of being able to identify whether or not the memory was indeed a true memory.
Right.
Was the therapist creating information around that memory?
Right.
It was really not a true memory. And I think it's still very controversial, Brian, isn't it?
It is, absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, one of my favorite scenes in The Nightbird is when Frankie meets Frost Easton for the first time, and she plays him this short 10-second video clip of a traffic accident. And then during the course of their conversation over the next few minutes, she starts to slowly feed him misinformation about what he saw in that video clip, so that by the time they're done, suddenly he's no longer sure what he remembers is true and what is false. And she shows him how it's little things that people can do, whether deliberately or accidentally, that begin to affect how people remember something that they saw. And so saying that, well, you remember that how that car zipped through the intersection. Well, when you start using emotion-laden terms like zipped and sped, suddenly people start to imagine that car going faster as it went through the intersection. And so when you ask them, well,
right,
what speed would you estimate it was going? Well, suddenly they start to accelerate how fast the car was going, because their memories
have
been changed by other information.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think is very controversial, particularly, you know, you're talking, this is a police procedural here, and police are always, they say they want eyewitness testimony, but I think eyewitness testimony has been proven to be somewhat unreliable in cases, although
that's still
the number one form of testimony. So,
right,
you know,
you've
got some controversial stuff and some controversial theories going on with The Nightbird. And by the way, congratulations on your success in this. This is a many times over best-selling book. And it really was another pulse pounder for me, I have to tell you. I've so enjoyed reading it.
Well, you know, I was truly overwhelmed by the success of The Nightbird. I think back in March, it was one of the, I think it was one of the top 10 or 20 most read books on Goodreads for the year. And I mean, it had an extraordinary impact with readers. I was just getting, you know, flooded with emails. And whenever you do something new and different as an author, and you start a new series and you introduce a new character, you're always wondering, you know, are readers going to come along for the ride? And I've just been overwhelmed by how much people have fallen in love with The Nightbird. And you know, obviously my hope is that there's some synergy here, that the folks that know me from my Jonathan Stride series and books like Marathon and Goodbye to the Dead will discover The Nightbird, and vice versa, that folks that now have found me as a result of The Nightbird will turn around and say, oh, I want to find out more from this author, and they'll look up Marathon and my earlier books as well.
Well, just let me tell listeners, just FYI, that Brian has close to 3,000 positive reviews, five and four-star reviews, mostly five, on The Nightbird. So his average review on that, and I'm going to try to see if I can find it, is like, I don't know, some outrageous amount, like 70% five stars or something. So it's to tell you that people love this book. I did too. It was
I'm really have a difficult time sometimes reading such psychological stuff because, you know, I'm so easily influenced. I really am. I'll be sitting up nights thinking about it, you know, playing it over and over in my head and thinking, oh my God, what if, you know, which is
I do tell people, be careful about reading that one at night.
Yeah. Well, and for me, it's the only time I can read. I read after my long day. And
sure. Yep.
But it just really, this one really had an impact on me. And I'm glad you told me that you read about Liz Loftus because she's so well known in the advocacy community and in police,
yeah.
You know, communities to law enforcement and everything. Her work is really stunning. And, you know, I can't tell you which way I fall on it. It just is what it is. I'm curious to know why thrillers, Brian, why thrillers and mystery and suspense? Where did that love come from?
Well, at least to some extent, I always blame it on my grandmother because she was the big mystery reader in the family. And I can remember growing up, she would tell me, oh, I'm reading this great new book. It's got lots of bodies in it. So that was kind of the book milieu I grew up in. So you knew what I was going to do when I grew up. You know, I really enjoy what thrillers can let you do from an emotional standpoint. And that may sound a little strange, but I really think that thrillers offer you a great way to kind of, you know, take a look inside the human soul and because you're putting people in some very extreme situations and you're seeing how those extreme situations and those dramatic events change their lives and how it changes their relationships with people. And so, you know, I don't like to write, you know, kind of sterile thrillers where it's simply all about the action on the page. I mean, there's plenty of action in my books, but I also want you to really connect with the characters. And certainly there are plenty of times when I'm writing these books that, you know, I've got tears running down my face because I'm so caught up in what's happening to these characters. And I always feel that if I can get that, you know, attached to them and that caught up in their stories, that readers will as well.
I think that's true. I want to ask you, I will not ask you about your writing habits because we discussed that already. I want to make mention of your website, though, and it's B. Freeman Books. You've really got to check out Brian's website. I want to give you just such a loud shout out because on your menu bar, you have the author's wife. It is so, I don't think I've ever seen that before. And I often talk to writers who will talk about their spouse and how important they are being their first reader and all, but you actually have given tribute to Marsha on your page. I have to tell you, you're my new hero today for doing that.
She is my hero. So Marsha is truly my partner in every aspect of this business. And we talked about this a few years ago, because obviously, sure, she's, you know, heavily involved in the creative side, and she's my best editor and my toughest editor, and that's what you need in this business. But she is also able to kind of bring people inside the day-to-day world of you know, being an author and the publishing business and some of the crazy things that we go through in a way that you know that I really can't. And she can connect with readers. I mean, she's just so good at reaching out to people. And I mean, she's just she's all over, you know, all the comments that people make on social media. She pays attention to all this, and she's always posting, you know, little kind of, you know, down to earth stories about that, you know, little insights into, you know, what it's like being a part of this business. And and so it means that, you know, with the two of us working together on this, I mean, we can reach so many more readers and hopefully touch some more people's lives. And certainly I know for me, I mean, it would just be absolutely impossible for me to do what I do if she didn't have such a huge role in this business.
Well, to further the shout out, I want listeners to know you can go to facebook.com/ the author's wife and like Marsha's page, where she posts just really interesting things. One of her posts was about squishing the tube of toothpaste versus rolling up the tube of toothpaste. That is to tell you how down to earth this woman is. You've got to go and see her page. And she has pictures posted of when you're at books stores and so on and so forth. But it's lovely. It's just
I will tell you a story that I don't think anybody other than Marcia and me know in this world. But the first time that I ever asked Marcia to marry me was when we found out that we were both squishers of the toothpaste tubes.
Well, good for you.
Sometimes you just know, you know.
It's just the little things that make a difference. You know, it could have been the opposite. She could have said, oh, no, you're roll the toothpaste tube up. Forget that noise. But, you know, I can really appreciate that. And I, as I say, I've spoken to so many writers who, you guys are my celebrities. You know, I don't own a television. Some of my friends think, oh, well, that's, you know, that's not very good. And, you know, is that good? And I say, yes, you know, keeps me on the straight and narrow, and I can read the books of all my guests. But I love the fact that you've paid kind of a little homage to Marcia here, and she deserves it. So hello, Marcia, big shout out to you. Go check out her website. Let's talk a little bit more about other things. You know, when we were talking before the show, I said to you that I generally throw away the press release. Tell me what's new in your life. Are you writing right now, or are you on hiatus from writing?
Oh, I'm never on hiatus. There's always some project I'm working on. I wrapped up the next Frost Easton book just about 2 weeks ago, and so we're through the editorial process on that. I'm really, really excited about this second book in the Frost series, also based in San Francisco. This one is called The Voice Inside, and it is going to be out on January 30th of next year. And I'm wrapping up a couple pitches for new books this month, and then I will be diving into the next Jonathan Stride novel this summer. And so I will be going full speed ahead on that. And I'm expecting the new Stride novel to be out probably around the same time the marathon was this year. And the working title of the new Stride novel is going to be Alter Ego. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
That sounds good. Sounds good. Brian, have you ever had an interest to write outside your genre?
You know, I do. I would actually love to do more of that. I actually have a couple books out that are not thrillers. A few years ago, I wrote a book that was kind of co-authored with my agent in London. It was a book called The Agency, and a lot of people don't realize it was me because it came out under a pseudonym, and the author's name was actually Allie O'Brien. And we had a great run with The Agency. It was reviewed in People magazine. We got some wonderful feedback on the book, but it's nothing like my thrillers. This one was sort of Sex in the City meets The Devil Wears Prada. It had a female first-person narrator. It was set in London and New York. It was just a hoot to write. I think it's a hoot to read. And then I did a follow-up book to The Agency called West 57, and that came out about 18 months ago. And West 57 came out under kind of a shortened version of my name.
B.N. Freeman, right?
B.N. Freeman, yeah. Unfortunately, my dear and lovely agent Allie in London passed away just a few years ago, and coming out with this, 45 years old, just absolutely tragic. So you know, it took me a while to kind of decide, did I even want to do a follow-up book, because Allie was such an important part of The Agency. But I had another story that I thought really needed to be out there, and some wonderful characters to tell. And so I put out West 57, and we had a wonderful run with that. It's one of my own personal favorites among my books. It again is not a thriller at all. It's sort of romantic and you know, a lot of intrigue and drama, but in a very sympathetic way. It's a lot of fun to read. It was a lot of fun to write. And you know, people will sometimes read my dark thrillers and they'll meet me and they'll go, well, gosh, you know, You're nothing like your thrillers. How can you write such dark stuff? And I tell them, well, go ahead and read West 57, because oddly, West 57 is probably closer to who I am as a person than the thrillers that I write.
West 57 feels like a cozy mystery to me. Would that be accurate?
No, not really. It's almost more of it's closer to chick lit really than it is to mystery. I mean, there's some mystery elements in there, but it's really at heart it's the story of this this woman in the publishing industry whose father was the owner of this kind of big time independent publishing house, and he passes away and leaves her this publishing house, which is sort of a white elephant, and it's in financial distress, and she's trying to figure out what the next steps in her life are and how to make this work. And in the midst of that, there are some little mysterious elements that crop up. But at heart, it really is about her choices in life and how she decides kind of what she's going to do in her life and how she deals with the loss of her father, who kind of keeps coming back in the book as sort of a ghost and sort of a memory too, and they have this banter going back and forth in the book, and those are some of my favorite scenes in the book.
Tell me about the awards that you've won and been nominated for, because, you know, authors don't like to brag, but I think you should, and I think they're important because, well, you know, here's the thing. You earned it, and these are your peers who are telling you that you've done a good job, and readers, because, you know, we get to vote on stuff too when we go to the Anthonys and, you know, things like that.
Tell
me about your awards, and what was the very first one that you were awarded? Was it the thriller?
No, actually, all the way back in 2005, when Immoral, my very first book, came out. We had such a wonderful run with Immoral. It was sold in 17 languages. It was named an International Book of the Month, and Immoral won the McCavity Award and was a finalist for the Edgar, the Dagger, the Barry, and the Anthony for best first novel. So it was quite an introduction into this business. And since then, I've been a finalist for the Minnesota Book Award 4 times, and the Audi Award for audiobooks a couple times, and then the Thriller Award. My fifth Jonathan Stride novel, The Burying Place, was a finalist for best novel in the Thriller Awards. I think that was 2010, and I was up there as a finalist with Michael Connelly, Mo Hyder, Jeffrey Deaver, and John Sanford. I thought that was pretty darn good company to be keeping. There's all, I mean, these giants, these icons and little old me. So Mr. Sanford took home the award that year when The Burying Place was a finalist. And that was fine. I hear that Sanford guy, he's okay. So he's another Minnesotan, so I have to.
He's a very nice guy, too. He's one of the nicest men that I've spoken to all of you, so it's really, really nice to know that I've got the circle of winners, in my hand here. And Jeffrey has been on this show. I can't tell you how many times I love that man to death. I would do anything for him.
He is such a kind, gracious individual, Jeffrey Deaver. I mean,
he truly is.
You read his books, and again, you think, how on earth can this lovely man, pen these just truly, atrociously dark things?
Yes.
And so,
yes, it's true.
Two years after The Burying Place was a finalist, my standalone thriller Spilled Blood was a finalist for best hardcover novel in the Thriller Awards, and honestly having gone to the awards and as a finalist and not taken home the prize the first time, I actually was thinking do I go or not, they always say it's an honor just to be nominated, but I'll tell you, it's a heck of a lot nicer to win. I really need to go, and so I went. I went to the Thriller Awards, and they do them at the Grand Hyatt in New York, and it's kind of like the Academy Awards for thriller writers.
They make a big deal out of it, don't they?
They do, which is wonderful. And so best hardcover novel is the big one for the evening, and they rattle off all the finalists, and I was sitting there, absolutely certain that they were going to call somebody else's name, and they go ahead and announce Spilled Blood by Brian Freeman,
Did you look around the room?
I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was one of the great, great professional moments of my life, and I have no idea what I said when I went up on stage and got the award. I doubt I made any sense whatsoever. And I made it back to the table, and two lovely booksellers from Minneapolis were at the table with me, and Pat, one of the booksellers, she got up and gave me a big hug, and I just totally lost it. I was just sobbing, and you know, very, very thrillerly,
wow.
You know, and I'm trying to text sure. Marcia to let her know that I had won, and my thumbs are shaking as I'm trying to key out this text to let her know that I won. It was and will always remain one of the truly, truly great moments of my life. It was just an extraordinary
experience. I must confess something to you, that I was there when you won the award.
Were you? Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. So did I make any sense?
Well, you kind of did, but you had this kind of deer in the headlights look in your face.
Oh, totally. I
teased Lori Rader Day about the same thing when she won the Anthony one year, and she just kind of was looking around and you know, had gone up to hug her, and she said, Oh, you know, so but I love that. I love the fact that someone who has never won before gets that award in their hand. It was amazing, and
it really was. And you know, and honestly, Spilled Blood is one of my very favorite books. It means a lot to me as a standalone thriller. There's a lot of emotion in that book, and so I was really, really proud that book brought home the award.
Well, congratulations on that. It was lovely, I have to say. That, you know, it's interesting to me. We talked briefly about this before the show, but you've been very lucky to have more than one publisher. I want to ask you about that, because many authors say, you know, I'm so frustrated that I can't get a book deal with a traditional publishing house. But you're kind of a hybrid guy. I mean,
Thomas and
Mercer, while that's an imprint of Amazon, is not your typical publishing house. Where Kirkus is, which is the Hachette Book Group. How did it happen for you, Brian?
You know, it's something I talked about with my agent a couple of years ago, and we were looking for some additional opportunities in the business. And you know, I think the way that the publishing industry has evolved in the last few years is that you kind of have almost two separate book markets at this point. I think you have kind of the traditional
yes.
book market, which has it has an ebook component, but it's still very heavily based on you know, print books and the bookstores, and then you have, you know, more of the independent market and the Amazon market, which while it has a print
yes.
component, I think it's much more heavily focused on ebooks. And it's almost like you've got two very different readerships at this point for those books, and very different ways of marketing to those readers. And so for me, I really like having a foot in each world, because it means that I can kind of take advantage of both sides of the industry, and I can market to both sides, and then hopefully again get some synergy going between from both sides as well.
Yeah, it is an interesting dynamic. Did you have an agent who helped you get published, who helped you find your publishers?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad. I'm really glad. I want to just remind everyone, you can go to Amazon and find Brian Freeman's books, and I think you sell your books on other booksellers as well, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't want to
Okay. Yeah, you can get them from some, you know, wonderful independent booksellers. You can get them from Barnes and Noble, I've been really fortunate to get have some wonderful supporters in all sides of the publishing industry.
I promised you that I was going to take 30 minutes of your time, but I'm keeping you, and I've kept you for longer, but I'm going to take five more minutes. Will you play final five with me? Five quick questions.
Absolutely.
And five quick answers? Okay, good. So I had to ask you this, one of my favorite questions to ask. What is something that we don't know about you that you're willing to share? What would we be surprised to know about you, other than the fact you're a squeezer, not a roller on the toothpaste?
Yes, we've established that. Well, a lot of people
yes.
are surprised. A lot of people are surprised to find that the author of dark thrillers, has been to Disney World probably 30, 35 times in his life. So, yeah, Marcia and I are members
really?
Of the Disney. Yes, we have. We're down in Orlando every year, and we're members of the Disney Vacation Club. So, yes, we're in the happiest place on earth, and I've never killed anyone there, and I promise I never will. So, but so yes, I'm a Disney file. So that is a little bit of a surprise, I think, for some of the thrillers.
It is, especially that you come all the way to my home state and you're only a couple hours away. You'll have to give me some heads up notice next time. I'll meet you for lunch or something. Oh my gosh, how about that? Funny, Brian. Whose book are you reading right now?
Whose book am I reading right now? I am actually reading the autobiography of Tippi Hedren, and she was the actress in The Birds and Marnie, who had a famously contentious relationship with Alfred Hitchcock. And I find that I can't really read my own genre anymore, because, you know, when you write suspense all day long, the idea of curling up with someone else's suspense novel at the end of the day kind of feels like work. So mostly these days I read history and biographies and memoirs, and so I've really been enjoying getting to know Tippi Hedren's life. It's a great autobiography. I highly recommend it.
Oh, good. Oh, I'm so glad. Is there a book that you will go to all the time to reread, maybe once a year, every other year or something, one that just is your favorite?
You know, that's a good question. I don't really think that there is. I certainly have a lot of books that have been, you know, important in my life, and books that kind of shaped me as a reader and as a writer. But I don't tend to go back to books too often. I kind of like to, you know, enjoy them and let that experience kind of settle in my mind, which is a little ironic, because I always tell my readers that you really ought to read my books twice, because you're going to pick up all the nuances that you missed
all
when
you were
rushing
stuff
to get to the end.
You're so funny. I had a conversation last night with Cassandra King, who was married to Pat Conroy. Pat Conroy happened to be truly my favorite literary author of all time. I think I've read Prince of Tides 20 times at least. I have to read it every year. I have to read it out loud, and I have to read it every year because it's so
mm-hmm.
beautiful. And I'm the most non-literary fiction gal you'll ever meet. I am strictly I read genre fiction for the love of books, but that book just makes me crazy. It's so good. So, you know, I can understand that, though, and it makes sense to me that you don't read in your genre. I wonder, do you worry that you'll pick out little bits of other people's books and it'll worm its way into yours? Is that a concern with thriller novelists?
You know, yeah, not really. I kind of just focus on doing my own thing, and I am trying to carve out my own little niche in the thriller business, in focusing on these very, you know, emotion-driven psychological thrillers. So I don't tend to worry too much about what other people are doing. In the early days, the only author that I had a hard and fast rule that I would never read when I was writing any of my books was Carl Hiaasen. Because he's just so wonderfully wacky that, you know, I was afraid that I was going to start having too many wacky elements in my stride thrillers, and that's just not me. So sorry, you know, sorry, Carl, not when I'm writing.
Yeah, he's so funny. You know, that's funny that you should mention it. You keep overlapping with stories in my life too. Being from Miami, I had the joy of reading Carl Hiaasen as a columnist for the Miami Herald before he was even writing books. So,
sure.
You know, yay for Carl. And he's delightful, and I've met him I can't tell you how many times. Wonderful.
I'm not sure I would admit to him my Disney file tendencies, though, because I know Carl does usually have a kind of a jaded eye for all things Disney.
Well, he does, you know, the mousetrap and all. Yes, he's not fond of Disney, and he's not fond of the overgrowth in Florida, you know, the expansion of the population, particularly down in the Everglades, too. So, yes, it's not his favorite thing. As you know, many of his stories surround those things. But how do you name your characters?
You know, the names come from all sorts of different places. Sometimes they just pop into my head and they just fit a character perfectly. Sometimes there's some meaning behind the name. For example, Jonathan Stride as a character was a very deliberate choice because he's a very intense, determined kind of individual, and I wanted a name for Stride that captured that kind of that step-by-step determination to get to the truth that he has. And so Stride just made sense for him. But, you know, then there's Frost Easton, and Frost Easton got his name because Marcia and I were driving down to a library event in Worthington, Minnesota, in southwestern Minnesota on I-90, and we passed a highway sign where the town of Frost was in one direction and the town of Easton was in the other direction. And I said to Marcia, "Oh, Frost Easton. Oh, that's a good name. I got to use that one."
Well, there you go. I mean, sometimes it's simple as that, right? I want to
exactly.
tell you that just for kicks and grins, there is a town or a city or, I don't know, I'm not really sure what it is, in Florida called Frostbite. Just keep that in mind. Okay?
And ironically named town at best down there. Yeah.
Absolutely. In Florida. Right. Well, we did have snow one year. I do remember that in 1976. I'm dating myself in Miami. It didn't stay on the ground, but it did snow indeed. I thought the heavens were opening up on us that day. My final question to you is when someone asks what your profession is, what do you tell them?
You know, I will typically tell them I'm an author, but I honestly, the one time I don't do that is when I'm on vacation, because I kind of steer clear of the whole question when I'm on vacation of what do you do for a living, because as soon as people find out that you're an author, it's kind of like when you know, people find out that somebody is a doctor, they immediately start grilling them about their aches and pains. And, you know, as soon as I tell people I'm an author, I'm in work mode, and suddenly I have to start marketing, and I'm talking about the books and you know, well, here's what they're about and what you'd like. And, you know, when I'm on vacation, I like to steer clear of that because I like to just be able to kind of let the book side of things
go. How about this one? Have I ever read anything that you've written?
Yeah, that's always a good one.
That's my favorite one.
Yeah. It's like, you're from Chicago. Do you know Bob Smith? Yeah.
Yes, I do all of them. Brian Freeman, author of Psychological Thrillers, it has been a delight speaking to you. I'm so glad that we finally got a chance to chat. Will you come back when the next book comes out, please?
I would be happy to.
I'd love to. And thank you so much for talking about Marcia and having this great discussion with me. It's been a joy to talk to you. I hope you have a delightful evening. Thank you so much, Brian Freeman. Tell everybody where your website is again. You can get everywhere from your page.
Exactly. It is bfreemanbooks.com, all one word, bfreemanbooks.com.
And I will tell you, you can just Google Brian Freeman. It takes you directly to his page. It's the first hit on Google. So go there, everyone. Brian Freeman, you're the best. Congratulations on all your books. And you and I will talk again soon, my friend. Take care.
Sounds good. Thanks so much. Take care.
You're welcome. Good night. And thanks for being with me, folks. I've really enjoyed having you and Brian here. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.